Green. And we're live.
So the unfalsifiability of security claims. It sort of seemed to me for quite some time that there's something a little bit wrong in security. There's something that funny things keep popping up, and it manifests itself in different ways. But I don't think I'm alone in that. In that feeling. Here's Adi Shamir making 10-year predictions and receiving the Turing Award in 2002. And he said, among other things, blah, 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 non-crypto security will remain a mess. And if you were to fault him on this prediction, I think, you know, you would probably fault him that he didn't extend it beyond the 10-year prediction, that we're in a mess in many different ways. And sometimes it pops up in small things that don't make much sense, or things that don't jive with others. And let me just give you one or two small examples of the very small things, but I think they add up to something that is that points to a problem upstream in our thinking. So this is from something, a Usenix paper that I and some colleagues had a couple of years ago on passwords. And when people are asked to choose passwords, we tell them, well, you should choose a password that's random and strong and stuff like that, and you should never reuse them across accounts. Okay, that sounds good. So I have about 100 different accounts, at least, and I think that's not an uncommon experience. So if I'd said 40 bits per password times 100 is 4,000, plus a couple of bits for bookkeeping and stuff, that gives you 4,500 random bits that you have to remember. I don't do this. You don't do this. The people who wrote this advice don't do this, because it's pretty much impossible. The human brain cannot memorize 4,500 random bits. Another kind of, it was a very small example, but a couple of years ago, this guy Jacob Nielsen, who's a usability and design expert guy, and he doesn't usually talk about security stuff, but he popped up and he said, you know, I think this business about doing password masking, this, you know, blocking out, putting in asterisks instead of showing the password, I think this is a waste of time and it does more harm than good. And that was fine. You expect guys like that to say stuff like that. And then Schneier, you know, saw this and on his blog said something like, I agree with this. I think this is a good idea. And then there was an epic flame war in the blogosphere. People pop up on Slashdot and they're calling each other names and arguing whether it's secure or not secure and stuff like that. And then 2 weeks later, Schneier blogged about it again and essentially reversed himself. And he wrote, so was I wrong? Maybe. Okay, probably. So what's the right answer? Yes? No? Maybe. I mean, there are many complicated questions in computer security, but this isn't one of them. This is something that in principle basically has a binary answer. Is it doing good or is it not doing good? And without, and I think it's worse than, not only do we not know the answer here, we don't know how to find the answer. Suppose, for example, all the funding agencies said, forget all the stuff you're working on right now. I want an answer to this question and stop doing everything else until you can answer this. Do we know how to answer this question? What would we do? What experiment or what analysis would we do to definitively answer this question? And I don't think we know the answer. And if we can't answer something as simple and as binary as this, there's something profoundly broken upstream in our logic, in the way we reason, in the way we reason about problems. So why? Why do we end up insisting on the necessity of things that are provably impossible? That 30 seconds worth of arithmetic will tell you that you can't choose a random password and never reuse across 100 accounts unless you use some other technology to assist you. How do we end up not being able to, not just, you know, figure out the answer, but not even able to figure out how do we figure out the answer on something that is basically a simple binary question? And that's basically what I want to get to, is I think that there's something very broken in our logic, and if we can get to it, maybe we can solve some of these problems and advance on things where we've not made progress. So in reading a bunch how people approach security, I mean, I read a bunch of things, and one of the things, I started reading some on science of security, and there's a good paper by Fred Schneider, on Blueprint for a Science of Cybersecurity, which appeared in the NSA journal or magazine a couple of years ago. And the very first sentence in the paper says, a secure system must defend against all possible attacks, including those unknown to the defender. And that's something that, you know, basically, you know, has a ring of truth to it. But I got stuck. And I got stuck not on whether this is true or not. I got stuck on something even more basic than that. And I got stuck on, is this a definition or a claim? Are you defining security to be this way? Or are you claiming that you have found it to be this way? That sounds like a philosophical distinction, but it's not. It's actually a very important question. So, by which I mean the following. Are you saying, I define that my definition of a secure system is one which defends against all possible attacks. That's what secure means. It means that and nothing else. Or are you saying that when I went out into the world and I saw all these systems, those that I found to be secure had the property that they always defended against all these attacks? Which of these two things are you saying? Because they're very different statements. And in addition to it's important which of these are you saying, no matter which of these two you're saying, I think there's a serious problem. Because definitions don't describe the world. You can't, I mean, you can define security to be anything you want, but that doesn't give us any useful statement for the anticipation of experience. And if this is a claim, so if it's a definition, it really doesn't help us make useful statements about how the world is and how to anticipate what we will get when we use things. And if you're saying you have found security to be this way, if it's a claim, it's a non-falsifiable claim. And let me show you exactly why. So claims of necessary conditions, and this is basically the sort of the main thing that I'm building around here. Sorry, the graphics are rendering not super super well here. But claims of necessary conditions for security are unfalsifiable. A necessary condition, just you know, your revision of set theory. X is a necessary condition for Y if X is a superset of Y. And I'm going to say Y is the set of things, the systems that are secure, or the passwords that are secure, the set of techniques that are secure, by which I mean bad outcomes will be avoided. So if this is the space of passwords, Y would be the space of passwords which avoid bad outcomes due to guessing attacks or something like that. So Y is you are secure, Y is otherwise. And the claim is no observation will ever falsify the claim that you have a necessary condition, that X is necessary for Y, that is, that X is a superset of Y. And proof is one line. To falsify the claim that X is a superset of Y, you must show that not X intersection Y is not empty. But you can't find anything in Y. We agreed that you can't observe that something is secure. You can't look at a system and say, yes, the system is secure. You can see that it's not secure if you see a successful attack, but you cannot see that it actually is secure. You can look at a password and say, no, that's not secure. I know it's on a dictionary. But you can't say, yes, this is secure. It's going to survive. So you can't observe that something is in Y. And that is what you need to do in order to falsify a claim that something is necessary to be in this set. So in words, falsifying the claim that X is necessary for security requires finding something secure that doesn't do X. And if you agree that you can't find something that's secure, you just can't do it. Okay. So so if it's a claim, it's an unfalsifiable claim. And we'll look at what that means and why it's a problem in a moment. If it's a definition, well, definitions don't describe the world. I can say, I define security to be, I define it to be anything I want, the systems that you know, defend against all possible attacks, for example. Let's say the people who use only secure systems live in here, and the people who do anything else live out there. Well, what's divide the population into those two sets. Now, what's the strongest statement that I can make about the difference in experienced outcomes between these two sets? Well, I actually can't say anything. A definition doesn't allow me to do anything. Is the average case better? You can't say that. Is the representative case better? Is at least one case better? Can you rule out the possibility that there's no difference? No, you can't make any of these statements. You've just got a definition, and a definition is not going to allow you to discover properties of the world. So that original statement, it's either a claim or a definition. And if it's a claim, it's an unfalsifiable one. Now, when I present this analysis, and this is like one line of algebra here. When I present people with this observation, people probably have the reaction that you are probably now having, which is you suspect sophistry. You think that there's something philosophical going on here with words, and you have an engineer's healthy distrust for philosophy. You expect that there's some fancy tap dancing going on, and this is something that can be made to go away. And you were already probably thinking of the, no. What I mean when I say secure is something else. I've got a way of making this go away. And there are various approaches to that. I call them basically denial, anger, bargaining, depression. And we have to go through those before we can get to acceptance. And I think so I want to just go through quickly to convince you that each of the escape hatches that you are probably already thinking of to get out of this difficulty get you nowhere. They just get you back into the same problem of either making tautological definition statements or unfalsifiable empirical statements, and there's no escape from this fundamental problem that we have here, and that I want to convince you that this is something that we need to grapple with it. So the basically, denial, anger, bargaining, and depression are security by design goals, claiming that insecurity is the possibility of bad outcomes, whether those bad outcomes are instantiated or not. That security is a property to be proved rather than one to be observed. And finally, that security is a non-binary property, that, you know, somehow in doing this set theory stuff, I've kind of built in a binary assumption that is not appropriate. So let me just go through them one slide each, and just to kind of quickly convince you that these go nowhere. So security by design goal is saying, no. I mean, security is not a statement about a particular set of outcomes. Security is to be understood relative to a threat model or a set of design goals. I have some understanding of what the world of attackers out there can do. I have some understanding of their capabilities. And based on their capabilities, I build in a set of countermeasures. And my security is either achieving or not achieving that set of countermeasures. So I have a certain set of goals. So let's call them, you know, these x0, x1, x2, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm secure when I achieve the intersection of all those design goals, and those design goals are informed by what I know about attackers. Now, this set is very different from the unfalsifiable set that I talked about before. We couldn't observe that something was secure in the sense of forbidding future bad outcomes. But we can certainly observe that these design goals have been met. So now we're dealing with a much more tractable animal, and that's really good. But did we actually solve the problem, or did we just kind of sweep it under the carpet? Well, what can we say about this set of achieving these design goals? Well, how can I know that achieving my design goals is sufficient to keep my stuff from experiencing bad outcomes? Well, the claim that it is sufficient is immediately falsifiable, in the sense that if your defenses are not sufficient, you get to see that when the bad guy succeeds in a particular attack. That is to say, you observe something that is in the intersection, you achieved your design goals, that it's an element of this set YG, but it's not, you did not manage to make it to your desired place in Y, which is secure against bad outcomes. So it's easy to see when things are not sufficient. However, how do I check that the design goals that I built in are actually necessary? Well, I'm back at the problem that I started with. There's nothing that will ever make me be able to falsify whether a goal is necessary. I picked some set of design goals based on an understanding of the world. Suppose I was wrong about one of those things. It's actually not necessary and I built it in. There is no observation and there is no analysis that I can possibly perform that will illustrate that I've made an error. I'm just going to live with that design goal that is unnecessary. So that the goals are sufficient is falsifiable, but the claim that it is necessary is not. In other words, all I've done is, it's not quite turtles all the way down, but I started with a problem and I put one more turtle under it, meaning, you know, I ended up back with the same difficulty that I started out from. We still can't falsify the claim that things are actually necessary if we can't observe something in the set we're seeking for. So how about insecurity is the possibility of bad outcomes? I don't mean a bad thing will happen, I mean a bad thing can happen. Well, okay, so let's look at the set, let's call it the set bad outcomes cannot happen. So if I get that will be, let's consider this set and K, you know, not K otherwise. This is so, K is the blue thing here, and Y was the original one that I started with. Well, clearly everything that can happen will happen. Everything that will happen can happen. So K is going to be a subset of Y. And a subset of Y is not going to be of any help whatsoever in helping me find a superset of Y. And further, since we said it was impossible to find any element of Y, well, it must be impossible to find any element of K also. So in other words, this is also falsifying the claim that you found a necessary condition for K is also unfalsifiable. I mean, and if you write this down, people often sort of, you know, use language and confuse the issue a little bit, but the claim that a bad outcome is possible means that a bad outcome will happen is equivalent, if you kind of work it out carefully, to the statement that K implies Y, that is, that something can happen and therefore will happen. That K implies Y means that not K implies not Y. which, if you recognize from your Boolean algebra classes, is just the logical fallacy of denying the antecedent. It's claiming that it's confusing a sufficient condition and a necessary one. That is, X implies Y does not mean not X implies not Y. So, for example, if you say defending against attack X makes you safe from attack X, it does not follow. It simply does not follow that if you don't defend against attack X, that you will succumb to it. And this is something that I think we'll keep coming back to. So, for example, I mean, an explanation of that puzzling observation that I referenced at the top, where we tell people to choose, you know, never reuse passwords across accounts. Is password reuse a real threat vector? I mean, do bad guys actually? Yes, they do. Do bad things happen because of reuse and bad guys exploiting this vector? Yes, absolutely. Can we eliminate that risk by avoiding reuse? Yes, you can. Does it follow from A, B, and C that D, that you should never reuse passwords? No, it does not. Just simply as a matter of logic, that does not follow, right? And what you're doing is, it is a sufficient condition to avoid any password reuse vector to avoid reuse, but that doesn't make it a necessary one. And confusing necessary and sufficient is, as we'll see in a couple of slides, is getting us into a lot of problems. So then, denial, anger, bargaining, proving necessary conditions. The claim that, and this is related to definitional or tautological statements, but the claim that you have proved something secure. Well, when we have a proof, right? A proof is unfalsifiable for less alarming reasons than an empirical observation. But a proof can't be contradicted by any possible observation, and if it can't be contradicted by any observation, then it's consistent with every observation. So it makes no promise whatsoever about how the future is going to look. I mean, a proved statement has no ability to restrict how the future is going to roll out. So basically, when we make proved statements, when we try to do, you know, provable security, or make proved statements about, say, a password of a certain format will stand up to attacks of a certain type. Generally speaking, we have a proof, but it doesn't start with, say, you know, Euclid's axioms. It starts with some assumption about attacker, about what the attacker can do and what the attacker cannot do. I think that's key, that we basically have any model starts with what a bad guy can do and what a bad guy cannot do. But it's important to not lose sight of, there's a very important restriction on the kinds of verification that we can apply to what a bad guy can do and what a bad guy cannot do. The claim that a bad guy can do something is verifiable. You can actually observe him doing it. The claim that a bad guy can do something is not falsifiable. If you think that a bad guy can compute logarithms in finite fields, there is no observation that will falsify that claim. And conversely, the claim that a bad guy cannot is verifiable but can't be falsified. And losing track of these two will lead us into mischief unless we're careful with it. Then finally, this one is really quickly taken care of, is, security isn't binary. Somehow I've done some trickery here and I'm talking about necessary things, and no one really believes security is a binary quality. We really understand that security is doing X is better than not doing X in some sort of scale or sense. Well, this leads nowhere also, because the problem with the binary security is we don't have a test for security. The problem with treating security as a scalar is we don't have a metric either. So the statement that the security of X is greater than the security of not X, well, how would you falsify this? How would you falsify the statement that choosing, that doing any countermeasure is more secure than not doing that countermeasure? You clearly can't do it by just saying, okay, the observed outcomes are going to be better, because that's not always the case. For example, the claim that the experience of people who travel on a ship that happens not to have lifeboats is in almost all circumstances the same as the experience of people that travel on one that does have lifeboats. The observed experience doesn't tell you whether it isn't a good guide to whether it's an advisable measure or not. So we don't have a test for security, and we don't have a metric for security. And this hugely complicates the kind of statements that we can make. So So just to you know, summarize where we got so far: denial, anger, bargaining, depression. It's so to summarize, a statement of the following form: if you don't do X, then claim. If claim is you are not secure, that is unfalsifiable or tautological statement for all X, for all X. If you say the claim is instead a bad outcome will happen or a bad outcome can happen, that's unfalsifiable or tautological for all X. And that's problematic. Making unfalsifiable or tautological statements are problematic if you're going to use them to justify measures. Now, so this is where I think is where it starts to impact what it is we do. It's like a lot of what we do in security, we have to decide on defensive measures to protect things. In other words, we have a whole series of things we say, you should do X, you should choose a strong password, you should run antivirus, you should do regular updates. And what I'm interested in is, what kind of evidence can I bring to bear? What is acceptable evidence to convince you that X is actually a valid countermeasure? And making statements of this kind seem to be, these are really problematic statements. And I think as we dig into it, we will find that a lot of the statements we make follow this format and therefore are very problematic. And therefore, some of the things that we insist upon are based on very not solid foundations. So an unfalsifiable claim, I mean, again, just to emphasize it, unfalsifiable does not mean morally wrong. It does not mean it's incorrect. It does not mean it's false. What it means is nothing in the observable universe depends upon the truth value of the statement. Say, I claim if you don't do X, then you are not secure. This is how the world looks if that statement is true. And this is how the world looks if that statement is false. There is no difference. In other words, you can search the entire planet Earth and measure everything on it to 9 decimal places for 1,000,000 years, and you will never find anything that will definitively rule out the truth of that statement. In other words, you're making a statement about that is in the truth of which is determined in an unobservable realm. So a reasonable reaction at this point is like, this is kind of highfalutin stuff, right? This sounds very philosophy. This sounds very unfalsifiable. I'm here to fight real bad guys who do real things. What's this got to do with anything practical? And can't we just ignore this? That's a valid question. No, it is. I mean, it's so. I want to convince you that no, that's not a valid approach at all. Consequences of unfalsifiability. The first consequence is self-correction is now one-sided. If you get things wrong, you will stay wrong. If you are incorrect about underestimate the abilities of your attacker, that underestimation will become obvious to you when a successful attack occurs. However, if you overestimate him, there is absolutely nothing that the observable universe will show you to confirm that fact. The second is, when you confuse sufficient conditions for necessary ones and you cascade them, you end up in an over-constrained problem space. You end up in things where you've decided that you have to do a certain set of things, and it's actually an unsolvable problem. And worse, you don't even understand that it's an unsolvable problem. And deciding how do we decide which unfalsifiable claims we should follow up on and which not. So first of all, self-correction is one-sided. New attacks can argue and new observations can argue countermeasures in. Nothing really argues one out. So assume, much in the threat modeling exercise, we assume that an attacker has capabilities C0, C1, blah, 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 blah. And based on that, we decide on a set of defensive measures, X0, X1, XN. Now, and I'm pretty happy with my set of defensive measures, and my stuff is there and it's being protected. If my set of defensive measures are not sufficient, this will become clear when a bad guy succeeds and I, in the morning, the money's all gone from my bank account or whatever bad. This happens when an attacker steps outside of the model and shows you a capability that you hadn't designed for or didn't suspect. So, for example, here's a dog jumping over the fence and, I didn't suspect that he could jump that high. That's what we're used to, the idea of scanning for the possibility that our defenses are insufficient. What I'm trying to persuade you of, there is a second danger that we are really not alert for, which is that my defenses have gone way beyond what is necessary. that, and there is no possible observation. So to give you kind of an analogy, suppose I actually am trying to build a fence to keep dogs in, and I decide 8 feet is the height of the fence to keep, you know, German shepherds and things like that in. Well, if one day a German shepherd manages to jump 9 feet over the fence, I decide, well, that clearly was not enough. But suppose I become ridiculously excessive and I say 20 feet, every dog fence on the planet should be 20 feet, and people listen to me and people build that into standards and best practices and stuff like that, and every Chihuahua and Pekingese and Corgi owner on the planet builds a 20-foot fence. There is no observation anywhere that will illustrate the overkill that's gone on here. And suppose some rival guy says, I think that guy Hurley with the 20-foot fence is full of nonsense. I've just used 10-feet fences everywhere and it works fine. Well, there is no observation, there is no refutation for the claim, you've just been lucky so far, sooner or later, somewhere down the line. So there is two kinds of danger here. We're much more familiar with the first kind of danger, is that you don't do enough. But if you do too much, there's no observation that will show you that you've done too much, and that cost, particularly if it's not a one-time cost, if it's an ongoing cost, will stay on the books forever. So you've got to be very, very careful when you do these things for the possibility that you're overkilling. So overkill is not detectable, is basically the observation. Second, confusing sufficient for necessary. I mean, it seems reasonable in security. Well, you know, we have to over-design, we do some stuff. You wouldn't want to fly in planes built by optimists and stuff like that. And so I've got a whole bunch of necessary. Suppose I've got a whole bunch of necessary conditions. The problem with confusing sufficient for necessary becomes clearer when you consider a lot of conditions and not just one or two. A necessary condition is a superset of the set that I'm trying to achieve as being secure. And suppose I have, you know, a dozen or 20 or 200 of these. Well, the intersection of a whole bunch of supersets is still a superset of whatever I was aiming for. But suppose instead of this, I actually confused. I didn't have necessary conditions because I've got no way of truly checking that I have a necessary condition. I actually have sufficient conditions. Well, sufficient conditions are subsets, not supersets. And being in a subset, when you cascade them, the intersection of a whole bunch of arbitrary subsets of Y isn't even guaranteed to be non-empty. In other words, I've convinced myself that I have necessary conditions. They're not necessary conditions, they're actually sufficient conditions, and when I cascade them, there is actually no solution to the problem that I'm seeking. Which I think is exactly what happened with this password reuse case here, is that somehow we said, I start with one password, and now I have a second password, and said, well, if you reuse, there's a risk that a bad guy will get it. So I replace what is a sufficient condition and consider it necessary, and then I iterate out to 100 or 200 or whatever number of passwords, and I end up with an unsolvable problem without even realizing that that's what I've done. So there's real danger here. There's real danger when there's cost in each of the countermeasures. And then finally, it's not usually mentioned in polite society, but I'm not a polite guy, and so the word unfalsifiability is, I don't want to be too antagonistic, but this is essentially the demarcation line that the rest of the scientific community places between things that are scientific and things that are not scientific. This is the criterion, you know, that this guy Popper came up with to demarcate things like the pursuit of witchcraft and the spoonbenders and the cargo cult guys and the paranormal people from the stuff that the rest of us recognize as science. So I'm not going across this line may sometimes be necessary. But, you know, it is not something to be done in a blasé fashion. And doing it without realizing that that's what we've been doing has serious consequences and don't have, and we need to kind of address and grapple with them. So is that what I'm saying? Is that the punchline of the talk? I mean, it basically, I came here to call people names and say computer science, security is pseudoscience, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, that's not the punchline. And actually, I don't believe that is the case. I mean, because if you look at, say, something like the astrology and, you know, the trying to figure out people's character from, you know, the cranial bumps and stuff like that, that stuff is just pure nonsense. There is no basis whatever to it. If you take stuff like this, you know, and no one has made more fun of these, you know, stupid password rules probably than I have, This is, you know, not particularly well thought out or well justified, but it's not based on nothing. This is based on some particular model. It's not like the witchcraft and astrology and things like that. there's something behind it. There's a falsifiable claim behind it. It's just that we're not it's not presented here, and this is based on some model of the world which may or may not be accurate. And that's, I think, what the problem is. Is that not that we're doing things that are out and out pseudoscientific, it's that behind the statements that are not strongly justifiable are more justifiable statements, but they're of a different character than what we actually say. So finally, okay, that was denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I think once you're convinced that, okay, making unfalsifiable claims has a cost to it, and I don't want to do that, so I want to get on the right side of this. So the final answer is, okay, I didn't mean it so literally. Don't be so literal about it. When I said this, you know, when I said that something is necessary for security, I meant it to improve things in some way. When I said the security of X is better than the security of not X, I didn't mean to invoke an unfalsifiable statement like that. What I meant is to say the outcome in certain circumstances will be better if you do X than if you do not X. So the outcome given A, B, C, D is better when you do X than when you don't do X, for some assumptions A, B, C, and D. Okay, so that actually starts to get us moving in the right direction. This actually has, you know, puts us making claims that are falsifiable and good and healthy, and, you know, we can, you know, not feel we're on the wrong side of a stark line like unfalsifiability. But let's not pat ourselves on the back just yet, because let's look at what actually happened here, which is, okay, so we often make statements like the security of X is greater than the security of not X, when instead we should have been saying something like the security given A, B, C, and D, the outcomes for X are better than the outcomes for not X in those cases. Well, so are we good now? Well, so a couple of things happened here. Like, what is the difference between these two statements? Well, the first is, you know, you hugely expanded the scope. When you say the outcomes given A, B, C, and D, well, that means if it's not A or not B or not C or not D, then you've made no statement at all. So when you tell me, when you make this statement, you've hugely expanded the scope beyond what you can actually justify. Even assuming that you can strongly justify this statement, making this statement is just an enormous overclaim, depending on how narrow A, B, C, and D are. So we've just overclaimed. Secondly, it's very easy when we start rephrasing things from this format to talking about security for forgotten, implicit, and vague assumptions to creep in. It's a great way of not saying precisely what it is you mean under cover of, you know, I'm mapping things under cover of, you know, essentially simplifying what's going on. And then third, I think that this is kind of the key point, is that, well, if you look at here, if this is my justification, the outcome, you know, doing X is better when A, B, C, and D apply than not, the entire justification for doing X hinges on how plausible it is that A and B and C and D actually happen. And so when you rephrase from this statement to that statement, you left out the only thing that matters. You left out the piece of information that will allow me to decide whether I should invest in X or not. The size and the scope, set of circumstances under which it will generate a benefit. So it's going to demonstrate, you know, how easy. I mean, it might seem, and I know much of this seems abstract, but to make it a little more concrete, right? To take say forgotten and implicit assumptions. We don't forget assumptions, right? We're very careful and we document them and write them down. Not altogether so, I think. So look at, for example, here's one password, which is, you know, a whole bunch of bits and it's random and it's doing, you know, all the kind of stuff that people would recommend. And here's a password that is, well, it's not too bad, it'll stand up to, but it's, you know, many people would feel very, very, very happy with the statement, the security of this password one is greater than the security of password two, that password is a stronger password, that there is some inherent quality that has been attained that is better about this. Well, so So I actually have been using at a large online retailer a password that is considerably weaker than the second one here for the last, you know, 15 or so years. So is that a counterexample to the claim that the outcome for this one is better than that one? Well, no, you've just been lucky so far. Or put another way is like, well, okay, the outcome is expected only to be different if the password file leaks, right? So there was an assumption here that kind of that didn't get mentioned. Well, and if the password file leaks, that's not quite the whole story either. Well, if the password file leaks, but it's stored in plain text, then also there would be no difference in the outcome between these two cases, right? Or if it was reversibly encrypted, right, then, you know, if it's reversibly encrypted and the guy gets the file, he either gets the key or he doesn't get the key, and he either gets plain text again or he gets gibberish. Or, I guess, if it leaked and my password was reset before anything bad actually happened. So my point here is that when we said the security of this password was better than the security of that password, we left out, you know, A, B, C, D, at least these, and there's actually a much longer chain of assumptions that kind of stretches to the horizon. And what's happening is that the claim is getting narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower. And the set of circumstances that have to apply in order for there to be an observable, discernible difference between these two is getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And when I express it this way, when I say the strength of one is greater than the strength of the other, or the security of one is greater than the security of the other, I obscure all of that. I'm speaking as though there is an abstract Platonic good called security, increases in which are inherently good. No, that is not the case. If, you know, if not A or not B or not C or not D, then there is no difference whatsoever between these. To claim that the security of this is greater than the security of that, if any of these conditions don't hold, is to claim that there is some unobservable inherent good, and you're essentially making what, you know, would be called a metaphysical claim. You're making a claim which will manifest itself in the observable universe never, and those are not the kind of claims that we want to be making. So the exercise I just went through there of flushing out the assumptions. So it's very difficult when you argue for a measure and you argue in favor to make sure, how can I make sure that I've actually got all of my assumptions, right? I say we should do X, and I can think of, and somebody asks me to justify and say, well, you can imagine a situation where a bad guy does this and a bad guy does that and blah, 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 blah. But what, I'm very interested in this, what can we accept as compelling evidence and be sure that we're not making errors? And I think the way to keep yourself honest here, and there's no one easier to fool than yourself, generally speaking, is it needs to constantly ask, what would it take to show me that I'm wrong? So when I claim that this password is better than that password, or you must run an antivirus, or you must do regular updates, what would it take to convince me that I'm wrong? Because once you can make that statement, now you have a clear articulation of the promise of the countermeasure that you're advocating, because you have a clear statement of the set of circumstances in which it will make an observable difference. And the smaller that set is, and that's what we saw happening on the last slide, is that the set of places where there was an observable manifest difference became smaller and smaller and smaller. So the claim that I was making got weaker and weaker and weaker, and the value of the countermeasure got weaker and weaker and weaker. So what would it take to show that I'm wrong? So I have a countermeasure. I think to be secure, you should do the following. I think in order to improve outcomes, you should do X. And ask yourself, what would it take to show that I'm wrong? And if your answer to that question is nothing, nothing would convince me that I'm wrong because I have a proof. You are actually promising nothing. If you're promising, if nothing would convince you that you're wrong, then you are making no statement whatsoever about the observable universe. If you don't know, you're confused about what it would take to convince you that you're wrong. You actually don't know what the countermeasure you're advocating for promises. Let me give you an example. Nothing falsifies. I have a proof. I have a proof that, you know, passwords of a certain flavor need to do better than anything else. Or take this for example, the kind of my running example in this deck is, if you don't use a unique password per account, then a bad guy who gets into one of your accounts can compromise several of your others. That sounds like a good argument in favor of never reusing passwords, and a rewording of that is more or less the argument that you'll always see. Well, you can rephrase that statement. I apologize, the fonts didn't come out super well here. If you don't do X, then a bad guy can do something not made impossible by X. And that is a true statement. There is no possibility that someone is going to be able to come up with something that refutes it. But it's a tautology. And tautologies do not make useful statements about the world. You can't make tautologies do not give you tools for anticipating future future experience. So, for example, I can use this tautology to justify very many things. If you don't use a Faraday cage, then a bad guy who gets close enough can steal your private keys over electromagnetic. These are two instances of this particular unfalsifiable or tautological statement. And if A is a convincing argument against password reuse, then B is a convincing argument against Faraday cages. I mean, for Faraday cages. But clearly, no one uses a Faraday cage, and password reuse is actually a pretty risky. So what's the difference here? I'm not arguing that using a unique password per account or avoiding reuse is as silly as using a Faraday cage. What I'm saying is, this is a sensible countermeasure in many circumstances, and this one is almost never. But the real justification isn't written down here. The real justification is, if you don't use a unique password per account, and then a bad guy gets one, can get into your other accounts. And this is a plausible attack. This actually happens. It is the plausibility of the set of circumstances under which there will be an observable difference that is the justification, not the tautological statement saying, if you don't do X, then a bad guy can do something not made impossible by X. So a tautological statement, you can't be immune to contradiction and make useful statements about experience. Once you, if there's nothing possible that will prove you wrong, then you're really making no explicit promise about how outcomes will be improved with the measure that you're advocating. The second one I want to talk about is like, well, I don't know. I'm actually confused or unsure about what would get me to admit that this countermeasure isn't worthwhile. And I think that this is the case with actually a lot of countermeasures that we have. So, for example, what would convince us that that this is a waste of time? That these, you know, kind of upper lower and, you know, the password composition policies that, and I'm not honestly sure. I mean, I'm not honestly sure that we could agree upon what piece of evidence, what observation, or what analysis would say this is comprehensively. We can now throw this. In the dustbin. I think that's exactly what happened with the argument between. I was going to say the argument between the guy Nielsen and Schneier, but it was actually the argument between Schneier and Schneier with Schneier and Schneier 2 weeks later. What would convince us that password masking is a waste of time? Well, we don't know, right? I mean, would it be an A-B randomized trial over what length of time, over what subset of users, over... I think if you start to ask the question that way, you begin to think in the right direction. But the real reason that neither I nor Schneier nor anybody else can get to an answer is we don't actually know what this countermeasure is doing. If we're confused about what would overthrow it, we're confused about what it's actually doing there in the first place. And the similar thing, I think, is, you know, antivirus. Well, antivirus, it certainly doesn't do nothing. It's certainly a very useful thing. But what precisely does it do? What precisely would convince me that antivirus doesn't do as good a job as I think it is doing? Password aging and expiration, and this is one where we kind of have made some progress in the last 2 or 3 years of people saying, yeah, you know, this stuff of making people change their password every 90 days doesn't seem to be doing as much. But I think more interesting than knocking that one silliness off the table is how did we get here in the first place, and why does it take so long? And if you look at if you try to find what would it take to convince me that this doesn't work? What is the actual justification for it? You will find, you know, blogs with waffle and weasel words and analogies and, you know, pointers to pointers to pointers to best practice documents, but you won't find anything that we will actually find, would consider as a solid, falsifiable, contradictable statement that promises promises something. The falsifying, falsifying, I think, was really extremely useful in flushing out. It's all too easy to argue for countermeasures, and I think if you go back to each of these things and many, many others, is that if you think about it and think about it hard and try to do this exercise and ask yourself, what would it take to convince me that I'm wrong about antivirus or about, that's not to say that I want to make antivirus go away, but just to clarify for yourself, what precisely are the assumptions under which this is making a difference? It has the beneficial side effect of flushing out the assumptions that you've made, some of which are implicit and very difficult to, for example, with password expiration, is it trying to cut down on the amount of time that that a bad guy has to guess the password, or is it cutting down on the amount of time that he has to use the password? Or I think we have a rather confused understanding of what it's actually trying to accomplish, and it's difficult to make improvement. You know, we have a set of countermeasures. It's very difficult to improve the return on investment of your countermeasures if you have a woolly and confused understanding of what these things are doing in the first place. And I think that that seems to be the case in each of, essentially everywhere I look. And the value of having an explicit set of statements about what assumptions you've made is that, as I said, that's your basis for deciding between, you know, whether you should invest or not. It is the plausibility of these particular assumptions coming to pass. Because if we talk about security as an abstract good which is to be increased, then there's no way out of the following difficulty, which is, you know, well, what is the set of countermeasures that Snowden needs to protect his stuff from all the people who want to spy on his stuff? Well, it's some long, long, long list of things that Snowden does, including putting a blanket over his head and using a Faraday cage and all of that. So I wish him well, but that's not my problem. My problem is, what is the set of countermeasures that Cormac needs to do to protect his stuff? I fortunately don't have the attack vector that he does. So of all the things that he does, what subset can I neglect? Now, everyone will say, of course, it would be ridiculous for you to try to do everything that a high assurance, high value target does. But telling me that I can't do everything is the empty statement, unless you're going to give me some tools to tell me which ones to drop. And the only tools that you have, is comparing the plausibility of the scenarios under which each of these countermeasures actually makes a difference. The Faraday cage, yeah, I understand the vector, I understand that it works, but no, I'm not particularly worried about somebody being that close from being willing to invest that much to get to me. So the fonts didn't come out super well on this one. But kind of wrapping up here, look, the temptation of unfalsifiable claims is enormous. I mean, it is enormous. I mean, they're good fun, and I hate to be a killjoy, I really do. I mean, but when you make unfalsifiable claims, you get to make big, bold, emphatic statements, safe from the fear of ever being contradicted. And I mean, what could be better, right? It's like ice cream without the calories. It's just, you know, you get to say, the only secure system is unplugged, encased in concrete, and buried underground. What percent of the Fortune 100 have been hacked? 100%. There are only two kinds of people, those who have been hacked and those who don't know it yet. And when you make an unfalsifiable statement like this, it sounds like you're being very rigorous. It sounds like you are very precise, that you have spotted difficulties that other people have not noticed. And no, that's not what's going on at all. Exactly the opposite of that is going on. All that's going on is that you are exploiting the trick known to astrologers and carnival barkers since the beginning of time, which is you never take accountability for what you claim. You phrase things in wording so that you will never be testable as a matter of fact. And only when called on it do you, one by one, produce the caveats that will map this unfalsifiable claim to something that's more falsifiable and maps it into. And I think that this is not an abstract difficulty. This is, if you start looking for it, I think you will after a while, you know, find it hard to not notice it. The other reason unfalsifiable claims are, I mean, they seem like a shortcut. I know, look, users don't care about security and they don't do stuff, and it just seems like, oh, there's a shortcut that we can get to get them to do the things that we know that they should do. But, well, and unfalsifiable claims are a great shortcut, but how come we get to take the shortcut and no one else does, right? I mean, why are our unfalsifiable claims, why should anyone listen to our unfalsifiable claims and not to everyone else's? Because there's a lot of people out there who, you know, FBI Director Comey says crypto backdoors are a vital tool in fighting cybercrime. Consensus of senior defense officials in the U.S. government is that NSA surveillance may be the only thing that can stop the next terrorist attack. You know, it's a very... It's difficult to articulate a coherent position that says we should be allowed to make unfalsifiable claims, but no, other people shouldn't. And to keep things kind of logically consistent, it's best to say no. We're going to try to justify measures in things that using the tools and mechanisms that the rest of the scientific community would recognize as reasonable justifications. Conclusions. There's a problem with the way we reason about problems. I mean, we're using, not intentionally, but maybe not intentionally, I hope not intentionally, but unfalsifiable, vague, and implicit claims. And the effect is extremely muddled statements justifying a lot of the stuff that we do and ask people to do, protecting things. And that is not to say that those things are completely pseudoscientific and there's no basis for them. But in using these muddled justification statements, one, we're not being intellectually honest about it. But two, we are hugely overstating the strength of the evidence that we have and overstating the strength of the evidence that we have and overstating the scope, the things that we claim that it is inherently more secure to choose a password of a certain type as opposed to having a certain benefit in a certain limited set of circumstances. These are fairly large large overclaims. And much of this is really about, there's good news and there's bad news here. There is a problem to be fixed. And the good news is that we have exactly the right tool set to fix the problem. I mean, security people make it a point of pride to be constantly questioning assumptions and constantly looking for the chance, the possibility that they've missed anything. What I want to convince you of is that you need to worry about overestimating attackers in some sense, as much as, maybe not as much, but as well as underestimating attackers. We're very familiar to the idea, if I underestimate an attacker, then bad outcomes will occur. So we are constantly scanning the horizon in front of us for the sign that attackers may have capabilities that we haven't understood or that they've figured out some way of working around our model. We spend essentially no time considering the possibility that we have overestimated them, that we have built in to our defenses things that are wasteful and that are not accomplishing what we think they're accomplishing, and that are safely protected from scrutiny by the unfalsifiable, vague, or implicit, justification statements that we've put around them. And you might well, ask, oh, is this guy's really telling me that, I need to worry about overestimating attackers rather than underestimating them? And yes, because an abundance of caution does not lead to an abundantly cautious solution. It might seem that, like, oh, this is security. We can't take chances, so we just lard things up a little. You just err on the side of caution. But when you cascade many such cases where you're confusing sufficient with necessary, sooner or later, you end up in such a wasteful and overspend or overkill situation that what happens is not that you have something that is abundantly cautious. What happens is you have something that is overcomplete and for which there is no good solution. And what happens then is that I think what happens with most internet users is you look at this impossible array of things that you're supposed to do, and you can't do all of them. No one will articulate good rules to select which to do and which to leave out. No one will articulate a set of rules to how to prioritize them. So one ends up choosing more or less at random from this large selection. So the outcome of being abundantly cautious is that you end up with worse defense. It's not a free lunch. It's not, oh, we can just lard things up and we'll get better defense. That is not the actual actual outcome. And, you know, just the last line is, you know, on everything, you know, we have in security, I mean, I think it's a very powerful question to keep asking yourself, especially about the stuff that you're really, 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 really sure of. You're so sure of this assumption that you don't even think of it as an assumption anymore. Keep asking yourself, what would it take to convince me that I'm wrong? And if the answer is nothing, you've got a serious problem. And if the answer is I don't know, well, you know, don't come up with excuses. Don't waste your ingenuity and creativity coming up with excuses as to why we shouldn't hold ourselves to the same standards that, you know, other communities do. Keep asking yourself, what would it take to convince me that I'm wrong? Okay, that's I'll end on that. Thank you so much.
Hi, Justin Kappos, NYU. Really, really interesting talk. I'm curious whether you think that these claims and things also apply to situations like, let's say, you think about a one-time pad and the cryptographic arguments that go behind, you know, when you have a very well-defined model in terms of each party has this pad that's unknown to the attacker can only see, you know, some bits that are sent over the wire, so they can only learn, for instance, the length of it. Is this something that you also feel falls under this category where, you know, that the at least accepted mathematical proof for this is not valid because...
Valid and invalid is itself a slightly vague term. I'm less worried about things like that where... I mean, the consequence of making an unfalsifiable claim that something is necessary when it's not is that you spent wastefully. So suppose there's something you think something is necessary. It's the only way of doing something, and it turns out you're wrong. There's an easier and simpler way. Well, you might or might not be concerned about that, depending on how much overkill was involved and how much.
Sure, yeah, but I wasn't really in this case trying to talk about overkill. I'm trying to stay, you know, on the topic of, do you feel that a proof for something like this shows that this defense is adequate in this case? I'm not saying that it is the minimum.
When we do mathematical modeling, I mean, there is kind of a real empirical world, and kind of, you know, it is exceedingly convenient and good and necessary to often abstract things and say, okay, assuming that the endpoints are not compromised, and for example, in Diffie-Hellman, I assume that he sees G to the A and G to the B and can't do. These are extremely valuable models. Now, it's extremely important that you understand explicitly the assumptions in the model. I think, you know, in crypto, maybe there's a slightly better job done of articulating explicitly what the assumptions are, right? In Diffie-Hellman, it's clear. If he sees the endpoint, well, then, you know, no claim. I think in much of the stuff I'm talking about here, I mean, it seems to me more problematic when there's a real risk that the assumptions have not been adequately fleshed out. And I think that's the case with a lot of the password stuff is, what are the assumptions? I'm not entirely sure, and I don't think anyone else is either. And that makes it extremely difficult. So if you don't know the assumptions, you actually don't know the claim and the promise. And if you don't know what the claim and the promise is, it's hard to say whether it's doing a good job, right?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Dawkins.
Sure.
I think that what I see here is that when one makes a non-falsifiable statement, one must put a smiley after it. And my proof of this is that if one fails to do so, then people like you and I are going to make fun of the unsubstantiated statement.
Okay. Sometimes people like you and I are not necessarily in the room, right? So one of the difficulties is that, you know, if you look at a lot of the password stuff again, is that, you know, I think by now, much of the research community, there's been a bunch of really good work in this area in the last couple of years, and by now, many of the things like, you know, the expiration and the upper, lower characters. By now, the research community is realizing, oh, wow, these things are not doing the good that we thought. But since it was expressed as, you know, password strength measured in a certain silly way is this abstract good that is everywhere, all, you know, even if the research community has now realized this, there are armies of bloggers out there who are, you know, putting out best practices, and they will continue to do for the next 10 years, no matter how many smiley faces you and I put on anything,
yep,
right?
Yep, yep. Unnecessary guidance has the Craig Shergold problem.
Right. Right.
Hi. I'm going to make an unfalsifiable statement, or at least something that I think is, and please comment. All security researchers, when they were writing blogs and papers, adequately specified the attack model on which they're making claims of, then you would have had to give this talk.
That might well be true. I'm not sure whether that might well be. Well, it's not just a question of you know, adequately. It's sometimes things are written down clearly. Like, if you talk to some of the people, actually, you know, Paul Van Oorschot and I and Dene have done some stuff on, you know, password guidance. And Paul, I think, contacted one of the people who was involved in the original NIST documents, right? And they had an extremely clear understanding of the set of assumptions that applied for some of these composition rules, too. But, and they fully understood that they do not apply in the current circumstances, but they, you know, they were not responsible for the world ignoring the say, hey, you know, if A, B, C, and D, then the following will be true. But if not A or not B or not C, then no statement, right? Just because the original, you know, people wrote the assumptions down clearly doesn't mean that things don't get lost along the way. And in some things, I think it's been so long lost that we can't even remember what the original justifying statement was.
So what you're saying is that even if we aim as a community to include these assumptions clearly in our papers and so forth, it might not solve the problem if the rest of the world ignores them.
I think one thing that would solve the problem is being is maybe, as Crispin says, putting a smiley face on it and saying, you know, when somebody says something, you know, I think I know what you mean. You said the security of X is better than the security of not X, but challenge somebody on it. Because when somebody says, okay, I said this, but, and that's clearly not an unfalsifiable claim, but everybody knows this set of assumptions. Like, well, when the set of things that everybody knows isn't written down carefully somewhere, there's no way of checking that what you think everybody knows and what I think everybody knows is in fact the same thing. And this is the way ambiguity is a great way to generate confusion. So, for example, I mean, if you much of the debate on something, and I keep mentioning passwords because it's an example that, you know, is very visceral and affects a lot of people, but you will find people arguing about whether this password composition policy is more secure than that password composition policy. When you rephrase it in this way, it's clear this makes one set of assumptions, that makes another set of assumptions. You are comparing sets of assumptions, and you will argue in circles here forever. There's nowhere else for this argument to go. There's no halting criterion on this argument. Like the, you know, Schneier and Nielsen talking about, is this secure or not for password masking? There's no halting criterion for this conversation. So, yes, no, maybe is the right answer, right? Thanks.
I'd like to assert a unfalsifiable statement. If your adversary can see what you type, no such thing as a strong password.
If your adversary is what?
If your adversary can see what you type,
yes,
there is no such thing as a strong password.
Yes. I mean, when somebody goes around your model, then, you know, there is no difference in outcomes between what you think is a strong password and a weak password, correct?
Yeah. Key captures trump passwords. Is it falsifiable?
Well, I think the part about strong is unfalsifiable because it's not clearly defined yet. You know,
right.
it creates, when you say strong, it creates the impression that outcomes are somehow going to be different. And
yeah.
What you're saying is no, outcomes are. So, for example, a better example is if it's stored plain text at the server. There is no set of circumstances under which the outcomes will be different. So the claim that one is stronger than another is in some metaphysical plane where we can speculate, but there will never, this, the difference between these two in outcomes will not be manifest in this observable universe, right? Ever. I would prefer to say there will be an observable difference between X and not X under the following circumstances. And then you can say, okay, we could, if we bring those set of circumstances into being, you know, with a randomized A-B trial, and it might be a very big trial, or, you know, and sometimes, you know, you might not have to, you can at least bring about a set of circumstances where vulnerable is another word that it's very easy to construct an English sentence that makes you feel like, you know, the absence of vulnerability is good, or the increase in security or strength is something that sounds good, even when it is doing nothing for you in any possible set of circumstances, not in a narrow set of circumstances, even when there's no possible set of circumstances. And that's a danger that I think we've just fallen into over and over and over and over.
Yeah, and often what you end up with are the enemies of reliability, complexity and coupling, and you're striving toward a model of infinite complexity.
And none of these... Replacing the statement outcomes are improved in the following circumstances with security is improved, this is a great tool for increasing confusion and smuggling, you know, unidentified assumptions across the border, right? I mean, I'm in favor of building a wall at the border, and all assumptions must show their papers as they cross. I'm a bit of a, to use an unfortunate analogy. Okay, thank you.
Well, we certainly, in practice, we do make assumptions about the capabilities and the motivation of our adversary.
Right.
I work in a skiff. It's very much a Faraday cage.
Yep.
Do I have a Faraday cage at home? No.
Correct.
But completely right. Different set of adversaries that we're talking about in both cases. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi. Great talk.
Hi.
So I'm going to make a safety analogy.
Okay.
If I'm on a boat and I have a life jacket, I expect that life jacket to protect me from drowning.
Sure.
I don't expect it to protect me from a heart attack once I hit the water.
Okay.
So I'm kind of in agreement with we need to explicitly state our assumptions on what adversary we're defending against. And even potentially admitting to the fact that whatever security that we put in place is not perfect. I may still drown if I have a life jacket,
sure.
If you will. So I think the better thing to think about here is risk for if my defense is imperfect, what are the impacts of that, of the adversary winning?
I mean, so to decide on the efficacy of some countermeasure, I mean, I think like the claim that the outcome for doing X in circumstances A, B, C, D are better than doing not X depends, it seems to me, on, you know, the cost of a bad outcome, the cost of the countermeasure, and the size and plausibility of the set of circumstances under which the outcomes differ. The allure of mapping that complex, multidimensional problem, some of which must be done subjectively, like subjectively deciding, well, how do you know that somebody isn't right now trying to, you know, listen in on your system? The temptation to replace that complex, multidimensional question with a one-dimensional security is improved if you do X is very, very tempting. But we've simplified, you know, way beyond what is justifiable. Explicitly stating our assumptions. I wouldn't like to be misunderstood. I mean, I don't think anyone is advocating for not writing down assumptions. And I think, you know, pretty much everyone will pound the table and say, absolutely, you won't find anyone anywhere who says, no, it's okay to not write down your assumptions. But somehow we end up in this situation where if you look at, you know, what is the tip of the spear for most internet users, all this password and antivirus stuff, somehow we end up and we stare at it and I don't know what the assumptions are and neither do does anyone in the room. So somehow these things get lost along the way.
So if I'm an internet user and I have an account for, say, weather.com,
sure,
where I have very little data about myself, and then I have my bank account, then the risk of my bank account being compromised, I care about that more, right, than if my weather.com account is compromised.
So. Yeah, and as an internet, you're allowed to say, I don't care. I mean, you're allowed, right, to say, you have my permission.
But I think talking about that with, you know, Joe Schmo user is useful, right? Talking about taking risk into consideration.
And I think that that's one of the things that is difficult. I mean, the complexity of that. So, for example, take that problem, the running problem I had of, you know, I've got 100 different accounts, and there's the bank account, and there's my, you know, account as an employee of Microsoft and various other things. And clearly some of these are much more important than others, and some of them I don't care about at all. And it's the rule that all of your passwords should be strong and you should never reuse is simple, clear, and easily articulated. It's also absolutely impossible to act upon. Now, a set of rules that would be easy to act upon, unfortunately, has the problem that it is difficult to articulate in a way that even approaches the simplicity of saying just keep them all separate. So, for example, I don't. For some people, weather.com might be the most important site to them. For some people, Facebook is more important to them than their bank, right? It is difficult to articulate in a really simple way. But I think we shouldn't let the complexity of that conversation, using that as an excuse to make unjustifiably kind of strong claims, you know, we shouldn't do that because it's leading us, you know, it leads to the effect where the instructions we give people are simple and clear, but they're also impossible, and people just ignore it, right? So we have no effect.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Hey, Carmack.
Abe.
Hey, so first of all, I'm actually wondering if the argument you're making in this talk is falsifiable.
So what statement is it I made that you think is not falsifiable?
Your overall proposition.
No, so I think so. People sometimes no. People sometimes use this as a joke to come back at Popper. They say, oh, you know, falsifiability is not falsifiable. Well, falsifiable is the claim is not that thou shalt or thou shalt not do unfalsifiable stuff. I think I tried to structure it carefully to say, if you make unfalsifiable claims, the problem is that if you're wrong about it, nothing will ever show you that you're wrong. Now, there are some things where I don't care if I'm wrong because it's a one-time cost, right? Suppose you are misinformed and you think that Diffie-Hellman is the only way of exchanging a key, you know, over, and you think it's a necessary condition. And then somebody points out, no, there's something else. Well, am I going to throw Diffie-Hellman away and use this other thing? Probably not, because we've already invested the one-time cost of figuring it out, and the ongoing cost is not that great. The reason I talk a lot about the usability and password stuff is that here the costs are ongoing. You get something wrong, and you continue wrong, and the pain and the cost just goes on forever. But so the claim is not
actually, I absolutely agree. I always like to lead in with a joke, so. But I think you're right. You're not quite saying. But sometimes what it is you're wasting money or maybe a lot of money doing something you don't need to do
or time,
which is what. Yeah, well, that's money, right? It's a cost, right? And I make this argument all the time that something isn't worth doing just because the cost is too much and we can't get there. So, but I just want to add a couple of detail points. I think half of what you're arguing about is, and you're touching on this in a number of ways, is our use of language and the way we talk about these things.
Right.
And if you remember, you know, Steve Greenwald did a paper a number of years ago on E-prime for security, where he talked about the use of the our problem with the use of the verb to be. Like saying something is secure doesn't really say anything meaningful.
Correct.
Right. That if we say has the following security properties, et cetera, it's a lot more constructive. So some of this is just about how we're describing these things. In some cases, using the words that have ambiguous meanings or, like you said, implicit assumptions.
Right.
Like your argument of the password thing about nobody can handle 100 different unique passwords. The implicit assumption there is also nobody can handle 100 unique passwords if they have to memorize all of them. Right. And our assumption is that that writing down passwords is verboten. This also comes with the problem that assuming that all vulnerabilities, all risks are equal, and we have to address right. all of them, right? I've had contexts where I said, I don't care about people writing down passwords if that means they'll accept stronger, you know, more complicated. I don't want to say stronger, you're right,
right.
more complicated passwords.
Right.
Or longer
and
passwords.
And that's a good example of, I mean, people, I mean, talk about if you say writing down your passwords is insecure, and not having a really strong password is insecure. Well, writing it down is a threat if somebody has physical access to the location when you wrote it down.
Exactly.
And this is a threat, you know, in a set of circumstances where somebody can do a guessing attack. You know, these are very different. And I think when you write down the assumptions, you get, well, I'm more willing to live with this risk than I am with that.
Right.
This is a more plausible and more scalable vector to me than and
that's absolutely
all of that
right.
gets obscured. All of that gets obscured when you map it to this platonic good called security, which washes all assumptions away.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing you made the comment about how do we falsify things, like say, or can we about like say using antivirus? Actually, I think we can. That's not the thing anybody wants to do. Like, for instance, you could construct an experiment where you deploy 1,000 machines across the internet with antivirus and another 1,000 without it, and, you know, with certain, and operate them in certain ways and see which, you know, get infected
yep,
more.
Yep, randomized.
I wanted to do the same thing with firewalls years ago to show how effective or ineffective they weren't. You can't get it funded.
Well, randomized A-B trials do answer.
They answer some things.
They answer many things, and that might be the way to do it. But we have not done it.
It's a whole discipline, and it's hard to get it funded, and I don't think anybody wants to do it because
you also have the difficulty with the AV in particular that if you try to do a randomized AB trial over a large population, one running antivirus and the other not, an IRB board will tell you that it's unethical to run.
Thanks.
But you're right, otherwise.
Thank you.
I wonder if maybe the situation we're in here has an analog with medical research and health outcomes, in the sense that I think you end up with a lot of medical studies that are really well, you know, very targeted, the assumptions are quite explicit, and there's a very careful attention to experimental methodology.
Right.
And the researchers come out with a very narrow, focused result of it. And what's eventually absorbed in popular expectations of health can be entirely, ignoring any of those assumptions. And I'll make an example of, say, medical research into the efficacy of exercise for health, right?
Right.
So, you know, should we exercise at a moderate level for frequently and for long periods of time, or should we do high-intensity exercise for short periods of time? Should we wear shoes? Should we run barefoot? Should we stretch before we exercise or not? I mean, all of this stuff eventually gets absorbed, in the popular media. And doctors give advice to patients based on literally zillions of medical studies that had all kinds of variant assumptions with them. And people honestly end up saying, well, I have no idea what the right thing is to do. Maybe I'm just not going to bother to exercise, right?
Sure.
So we end up with the same kind of thing where the advice that's given really has little bearing on what the original research was. And in a sense, medical researchers don't feel obliged to take some kind of personal and professional responsibility for the crazy advice that people are taking out there. They say, hey, I did a good study, and it showed something very specific, and that informed the science. But now we've got some really crazy stuff that's going on, even doctors giving really strange advice to patients, that really doesn't have bearing on the original assumptions of these studies. They wouldn't give their patients that advice based on those studies.
Right.
And in a sense, we should be also careful about, you know, how much responsibility as a research community we take for some of the crazy, you know, somebody cooked up this list of, you know, password obligations, but you can't really say that there was, you know, some, you know, even, you know, in your Venn diagram, some very clear studies that would have suggested that one should even patch this stuff together to result in that mess. So I wonder, you know, we certainly should do what you've talked about, is look at making sure that our research is falsifiable and that we understand what that means. But it doesn't we shouldn't necessarily expect that's going to result in sort of the external IT community absorbing any of our results in a sensible way, right?
Sure. I mean, just to the last point first, I mean, I think I would kind of channel Phil Rogoway's talk this morning. We said, you know, well, how is this not our failing in the sense that if there's 2 billion people out there using the internet, you know, sure, if there's a vacuum, bloggers will fill it with stuff and just say stuff. And I think if we don't know, we should say we don't know. But, you know, it seems to me that there are many questions on how, you know, internet users can protect themselves that, you know, the research computer security community would be the natural people to own that.
Well, fair enough, but at the same time, I would argue that, you know, medical researchers certainly want to make people healthier, right? And they do that work with the goal of, you know, making people, you know, have, you know, fewer side effects from treatments or live longer or, you know, be stronger or whatever it is, right? People are certainly aiming that, and I would have to think that most of us are attempting and you know, Phil's point I actually agree with that as well, but many of us are really attempting to try to do real world effects. But the result being any study has to be has to control a bunch of variables, right? Which
Correct.
In the real world, you know, when you get to sort of the real world of you know, systems out there that live in a changing environment and bodies out there that live in a changing environment.
I think the hard part in medical research is, I mean, the gold standard in medical and biological stuff is randomized A-B trials. And the hard part is always establishing causality, right, you know, and correlation. And then there's the additional problem of you know, some studies don't replicate. I think, and there are definitely difficulties of, you know, are you, you know, what some things are hard to do randomized A-B trials on, but for ethical reasons and for all sorts of other reasons, and longitudinal things are difficult also. But I think it would be quite an advance if we could get to where medicine currently is in terms of, so for example, there's been kind of what's described as this replication crisis in medicine where people figure out that, oh, if you use everything at a p-value of 0.05, one thing in 20 is a false result, and this happens a lot. But at least in medicine, they don't have this question that Schneier and Nielsen were arguing at the top. It's like, we can't decide whether this is secure or not, and we can't even decide what would answer the question. If somebody claims, you know, that I do an A-B trial and this is correlated with that, well, someone who replicates that study, you know, with a bigger, you know, a bigger sample size and says no effect, that really calls the, you know, it's fairly clear what the ground rules are. And so I think medicine certainly has, you know, has some difficulties, but I think where some of the claims we're making are considerably worse than things that are based on A-B studies where correlation was found but causation is not established.
Well, the last point I'll make on that is simply that, you know, one of the problems they have in medicine is really ending up with some kind of correlation between the research results that have to be much narrower or more specific about, you know, changing of, say, chemical, biochemical values in the body and things like that, to whether that actually causes people to live longer or have a higher quality of life, right? And to a certain extent, that mapping is a problem that we may have here as well.
Sure.
In that, you know, we may, you know, whatever, even if we manage to end up with some more very tightly expressed assumptions and you know, better defined elements of our research, we may still end up with that, you know, what does that mean? Does that mean our system would be more secure, whatever that means, you know, under various conditions in the real world?
I think we can make things better without making things perfect, right? If we would stop presenting tautologies as useful statements to guide behavior, that would already be an improvement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rich Johnson, NCAR. A couple of the previous comments about risk dovetail really nicely with your point three and conclusions there. Worry about overestimating attackers as well as under. And the question then becomes, secure against who for how long? What are the attacker capabilities? What are their desires? Are they going? What is the likelihood that they will come after you as opposed to someone else? And building that specifically into your risk model and documenting it so you can avoid, shall we say, under the water assumptions going on. Everyone knows. Well, actually, not everyone knows.
Right.
That actually has allowed us to rederive why we want multiple character sets in passwords up to a certain length.
Right.
Because our default attacker assumption for stolen password hashes is somebody who has access to reasonably sized rainbow tables.
Mm-hmm.
And we document that and say, this is why. So our claim of saying we want to put multiple character sets in passwords below this length is not astrology. We can actually say,
sure,
this is falsifiable. If you get a better attacker, well, then we need to go longer.
Right.
No, I just wanted to make that point about risk model should incorporate your attacker capabilities. Otherwise, you can't actually define what's secure.
Yeah, no, I think it. I mean, it goes to like a lot of the stuff, including the stuff that we justify unfalsifiably. It's not like there's no basis to it. It's not like these things do nothing. It's not like, you know, there was never any reason for people to consider expiring passwords every 70 or 90 days. It's just that when it's based on everybody knows and wasn't really written down and becomes lost in the mists of time, and then it's difficult to argue if I know that this is if I know that this doesn't belong here, it's easy to take it and throw it in the trash. If I come along and I don't even know what it's doing here, it's much more, well, maybe I should just leave it. There might be a good reason it's here, and I don't want to take responsibility, right? It's as simple as that. Thank you so much. Thanks.